Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to Soupcast, coming to you from ArchaeoSoup Towers. By popular demand, we're taking selected videos from the ArchaeoSoup back catalogue and bringing them to you as convenient podcasts. As the name implies, with ArchaeoSoup, you get a bit of everything thrown into the pot. Archaeology, discussion, humour and debate. You can find out more at ArchaeoSoup.com. So sit back, relax, and enjoy a hearty helping of Archaeo Soup.
Hello, and welcome back to Watching Brief for the week of the 20th of September 2021. I am joined, as ever, by the excellent Andy Brockman, my co-host and collaborator extraordinaire.
Good afternoon, Mark. You're being far too kind, as you always are.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's so easy when I'm working with such a magnificent colleague. You know, you're a
Which one?
Okay, saboteur then. Let's go with saboteur. Anyway, regardless.
Gadfly.
Regardless of whether Andy is as a collaborator or a saboteur, our Watching Brief does in fact continue. Our ongoing mission to examine the archaeological news of the week and bring it to you here in the form of a video to add to the conversation and the discussion below. And this week we have a fairly dominant story, actually, a story that's been present in the minds of archaeologists, historians, and heritage professionals, and frankly, the interested public throughout the whole week, because it's really a pointer to the culture surrounding culture, actually, in the UK, particularly with the appointments of a new culture minister. So it's a real milestone and a bit of a mark of intent potentially. So it's something that we hope people will be interested in outside the UK as well. But before we dive into that, we have a couple of news lines that you want to highlight, do we not, Andy?
That's right. Unfortunately, we haven't got time to mention the fact that the Hobby Lobby has been forced to return the Gilgamesh dream tablet to the government in Iraq from whence it was looted. Normally, obviously, something like that. It's the culmination of a story we've been covering for some time. So mentioning again that the Hobby Lobby and its unfortunate habit of buying trafficked artefacts, we just haven't got time to mention that.
No time. And the thing is, it's just because they keep on cementing their position at the pinnacle of our Muppetry scale with that Lifetime Achievement Award. It's just embarrassing to have to mention it again, isn't it? We don't have to mention it. It's fine. We can move on. We can put it in a drawer, much like Hobby Lobby did.
Yes, until they were forced to take it out again because it had been looted. No, we just haven't got time to mention any of that, and the fact that, you know, an important artifact from ancient Mesopotamia is now heading back to the Middle East and the government of Iraq and Iraq's museums where it belongs. We'll park that one.
Okay. What's the second story?
The second story is actually equally serious in its way, and it comes from the world of UK metal detecting, and it's the collapse of a community interest company called Detecting for Veterans, which was set up 3 or 4 years ago now to facilitate veterans and people who wanted to support veteran causes, veterans from the armed services and the blue light services, to go metal detecting. It was quite high profile, it attracted a fair amount of coverage. It was very successful in obtaining permissions, which is the key to metal detecting these days. All appeared to be proceeding quite smoothly under the directorship of a man called Jason Massey. Then, just over a week ago, accusations appeared in social media that Mr. Massey had effectively been committing fraud by diverting money that had been donated to the to Detecting for Veterans by people taking part in Detecting for Veterans rallies.
Right.
Now, there appears to be an ongoing police investigation. Nothing is proven yet, and obviously Mr. Massey is innocent until proven guilty, although it is also alleged that it was announced that he was in hospital with a stroke and was very ill, when in fact he was observed by people who were watching his house connected with the company, literally almost taking out the bins. It was one of those tabloid style stings where you stake out somebody's house and watch their comings and goings. As I say, there is nothing proven yet. The investigation's ongoing, but the company effectively has collapsed in its website's its Facebook page has been closed down, and there are appeals to contact the police if people feel they've lost money.
Right.
So it's a story to watch, and I think, and obviously, you know, as I said before, Mr. Mass is innocent until proven guilty of anything. At the moment, there aren't even any charges.
Mm-hmm.
But whatever happens in the case of Detecting for Veterans, it highlights concerns that many people have had in the archaeological world for a long time about metal detecting rally companies and the lack of accountability and the lack of transparency in their operations.
Mm.
So I think regardless of what happens with D4V, the issues that are highlighted by what appears to have happened won't go away.
No. And it's always, I hate to say it, but it's always veterans, isn't it? It's always, unfortunately, it's a very attractive way of gaining attention and raising money. And in this case, it's potentially those, precisely those sorts of people who are vulnerable or people who are simply served who are also at risk of losing out here. It's a real shame.
It's his, and I'll just say very quickly, actually, a lot of the response on social media has been saying exactly that.
Right.
Yeah. So this is an extremely sensitive area. We're dealing with people's health and mental health and wellbeing. At the same time, one of the things that was said about Detecting for Veterans was it was very successful in land banking metal detecting permissions on the basis that it was a veteran, it wasn't a charity, it's a community interest company, which is a different thing, has much less regulation about it. But people were treating it as though it was a veterans charity, and it was gaining support on those grounds, understandably, because, you know, people want to support good causes, and supporting, you know, veterans of the armed services, particularly those with health or mental health issues and so on, it's a popular and needed, you know, avenue. So the fact that D4V appears to have collapsed in this way is, before it's anything else, it's upsetting to anyone who's particularly veterans and those who are raising money for veterans.
Okay, and finally, we have something from Stonehenge, do we not?
That's right. It's a news line, and it's quite a significant news line, I think. Lee Day, the legal firm that was representing the campaign to prevent the Stonehenge dual carriageway and tunnel going ahead, put out a press release a couple of days ago that the Transport Secretary, Grant Shapps, has decided not to appeal the legal decision that granting permission to build the Stonehenge tunnel and dual carriageway across the World Heritage Site was unlawful on two grounds.
No.
The government has stepped back from that. So as things stand, the position is that if they wish to carry on with the project, it has to be reassessed. It has to go to consultation again from interested parties. There is a break on... it's unclear at the moment whether enabling work is going to continue or whether it remains frozen.
Initially, the government was saying, regardless of the decision, enabling works continue, weren't they? But now, now it's unclear. Okay.
Yes. And I'm sure we'll return to this in due course.
Let us begin our main course, I suppose you could say, by introducing people to the Dorman Long Tower. This is a coal bunker structure built in a brutalist style in the 1950s, I do believe, in a place called Redcar. It's part of the Tees Valley Combined Authority. And it is here in the northeast of England on the coast. And it was built as part of Redcar's very proud tradition of steel production, smelting and export, which it's important to note in recent years has seen a decline and an eventual shutdown of that industry in that area. The last time I was in Redcar, I was buying a PC, oddly enough. But I remember as we were driving past some of these sites, and it was as that was in the balance. The question was whether or not these sites would continue, because once you shut them down, once you stop the furnaces burning, essentially the molten slag and metal and other parts of the plant become unusable. They sort of fuse, they cut, it's no longer alive. In a very real sense, the industry has died, and it's been allowed to die under what we should also point out is an extension of the current government. We've had a decade now of Conservative administration in this country, and this happened under their watch. In recent years, there was a proposal, was there not, to demolish this structure, and it is quite an interesting structure. It's got a very specific design. It's quite pleasingly symmetrical. It's also quite functional, a la brutalism, and it has the words Dorman Long written on the outside of the structure. It's very well, dare I say, even iconic. It could have been something akin to the Angel of the North or any number of structures that we see across the country. But that's no longer going to be the case because, unfortunately, it was demolished early in the morning on Sunday morning. How did this happen, Andy? What happened? Because you can see why some people wanted to keep it, can't you?
Yeah. This is a story of high heritage politics and, I think it can be argued, low cunning. Basically, the area where the Dorman Long Tower is situated, the former Tees Works site, steel works site, of which really the tower is the last upstanding marker, has been slated to become a wind farm production facility. Mm-hmm. Tees Valley Mayor Ben Hootchin, who is a Conservative and is fully aligned with the government's levelling up and development agenda, argued that the tower needed to go because it was in the way and it would be expensive to maintain. Local campaigners... Sorry, you were shopping, take a breath there, as though you were going to interrupt.
Well, I was about to say, but it sounds like you were about to say something similar. So it's interesting, though, that during the last election, it appears that the MP was standing on the grounds that the tower should probably be kept, subject to a spending review and it being shown to be viable. And presumably there were local campaigners who agreed with that stance.
That's right. A local politician wouldn't stand with that as part of their platform if there wasn't a local... interest in that policy, I think it's fair to say. So up until really 10 days ago, roughly, the situation was that there was a campaign to save the tower, and there was also a campaign on an intent on the part of Mayor Hootchin and the Development Authority to demolish it. What appears to have precipitated events is that the local authority confirmed a date of demolition. And then almost immediately, Historic England gave the structure a grade 2 emergency listing, which halted the demolition.
Yeah.
And this the Historic England announced the emergency listing on the 10th of September. The following Sunday, the 12th, according to Mayor Hootchin's press release, he and the Development Authority lodged an appeal with the Secretary of State for Culture, Digital Culture, Media and Sport, who at that stage was still Oliver Dowden. So basically, what happened was Historic England granted the listing. It was then immediately appealed by another party, and the whole thing legally is refereed by the Department for Culture, Media and Sport down in Whitehall.
Yes. The Department for Digital Culture.
Digital Culture, Media and Sport down in Whitehall. And here we need to point out and remind our viewer that the ruling party is the Conservatives, and Mayor Hootchin is also a Conservative.
Yes. As is the local MP.
As is the local MP.
Yeah.
So, anyway, to cut to the chase, there appears to have been a certain amount of suing, throwing an argument, and then on the following Friday, it was announced by the new Culture Secretary, Nadine Dorries, that she had taken the decision to rescind the listing, claiming that, contrary to what Historic England had said in its justification, that the building was of limited interest and was physically damaged and would be difficult to conserve, and there was no and therefore the listing was voided.
Well, she's also quoted as saying that it's clear that the building is essentially a functional structure, with that being a justification for it not to be kept. But as I was pointing out to you, that's a very flip-floppy, wishy-washy language. I mean, we could describe the Queen Elizabeth, is it the second tower? The tower that houses the Big Ben bell and clock mechanism, as being essentially functional. All buildings are functional in that sense. And yes. We'll come back to her to reactions to her qualifications to make these sorts of comments in a moment, I suppose, won't we? But anyway, continue.
No, you're right to raise that. It's an important point to make. It's interesting that in greeting Culture Secretary Nadine Dorries' decision, Mayor Hootchin put out a press release which contains various quotes. He said, approving our appeal was the first decision of the new Secretary of State. This goes to show just how important the successful redevelopment of the Redcar former steelwork site is to everyone in government. And then he said, essentially, it's a provocative challenge to the heritage groups that were involved. It's almost, some people might see this as almost triumphalist, but this is a direct quote from Mayor Hootchin's press release. This reverses the decision on its Grade 2 listing made after an application by local activists that, if allowed to stand, would have cost the taxpayer in excess of £9 million. That's money that would not be spent on the creation of jobs, the NHS, transport and other important services. Worse than that, it would have cost thousands of jobs and hundreds of millions of pounds of investment that we were and still are trying to bring to the site where the Dorman Long Tower currently stands. Now, that in itself, by using a loaded term like activist,
crusty activists. Those people
exactly.
Hanging themselves in trees and digging under the ground and gluing themselves to the motorways.
Absolutely. Yeah. And people who disagree with Mayor Hootchin would argue, for example, that he's setting up a false choice.
Yeah.
The choice between conserving heritage and the NHS is a false binary.
Yeah. Well, but also as well, the choice between conservation and progress. Being a false binary.
Absolutely.
Well.
And the fact that, you know, pretty much any development can be designed around something that something that already exists on the site. You know, if somebody wants to build something new in Canterbury, they can apply for planning permission as long as they respect the cathedral. You know?
Or for example, on the banks of the River Tyne, there was the construction of the wonderful Sage Gateshead Opera House.
Yes.
and music performance space. next to the Tyne Bridge, but also just up the bank, like within 100 metres, well, maybe 200 metres, of a former flour mill called the Baltic that was converted into an art gallery and serves the community very well. They didn't have to demolish the Baltic to build the Sage. So, as you say, there are more often than not, there are options in these cases. Mr. Hootchin also said, I would like to send a message to those that think that trying to stop these developments is the right thing to do. Our heritage does not lie in a rotting coal bunker, our heritage lies in the people that built this great nation. It lies in structures that stand tall across the world, from the Shard, Sydney Harbour Bridge, and the One World Trade Centre, which immediately struck me as being, again, a false dichotomy going on here. No one's suggesting that you keep a rotting coal pit in that sense, or coal bunker. No, necessarily. It's about the way in which that heritage is used and discussed and preserved. For example, I believe the MP put out a statement. And we should name him. I keep on calling him the MP. Jacob Young MP put out a statement saying that he hoped with the destruction of the tower that they could keep the lettering off the side. It looks like they didn't. The video shows that the whole tower fell with the lettering on the side of the building still.
We'll come to the timing in a minute.
Yeah. But this notion that in order to appreciate the heritage of the area, one should only look to one's people, the flesh of the people in the northeast of England, is, I hate to say it, it's actually pseudo-fascistic. And I'm not literally calling the mayor a fascist, but it's a form of history that's built in blood and soil rhetoric. The people are our history. That's not true, because the people are also subject to ongoing narratives about, for example, progress. This idea of standing in the way of progress, coming straight on the heels of having just allowed an industry to die in the region, is deeply political. So this isn't about a heritage narrative or actually taking pride in something. This is about shaping what people think of themselves and their region, which is a separate issue. There's also the question of, is he implying that people need to travel to London, Sydney or New York in order to experience their heritage if they're from Redcar? It's high rhetoric, but it's also highly flawed as well. It's not actually good. And I say, I'm not suggesting that the tower had to be kept. I'm suggesting that the heritage has to be better tret than it has been tret.
Yes, absolutely. But, you know, there are always arguments around heritage and what is heritage. And you know, for example, I think one of our colleagues tweeted out that, oh, if it had a statue of a slave trader on top, it would have been kept. Mm. Now, that leads me to a very, it's a sort of, a bit of a smart observation, but for example, what that's alluding to is the people of Bristol, or a group of people in Bristol, I should say, tearing down the statue of Sir Edward Colston and dunking it in Bristol Harbour. He's now been rescued and he's now on display again, but this time in Bristol Museum. Now, that event caused a change in government policy. There is going to be a whole new law to protect and prevent and criminalise that kind of activity in taking down statues. Mm-hmm. And Sir Edward Colston's statue had the same level of protection, grade two, as was being proposed for the Dormund Long Tower. Mm-hmm. You can see that there in two artifacts is the argument about what is heritage and whose heritage is it. But I think for me, the importance of this, and I guess it's the point I'd finish on, because I think this story has somewhere to go yet. Mm. And for me, covering these things sort of journalistically, the questions are about process. Mm-hmm. And the integrity of a process. Mm. Because on the face of it, Historic England listing something and then having it delisted barely a week later and having it blown up a couple of days later than that, it potentially, I think, has a chilling effect on the willingness to list particularly modern buildings that may be in the way of developments and developers, regardless of who they are. Mm-hmm. You know, why go through the bother of preserving something, of listing something, when it's going to be overridden by the Secretary of State? And in fact, the this is really interesting in that the listing status has been granted and then it was overridden. It wasn't the case of the Secretary of State intervening before listing. It was intervening after listing.
But also on top of that, we have the extra interesting element, and that is that the Historic England has gone so far as to stand by that decision.
Can I put that in context? Because that was going to be my next point. In his press release, Mayor Hootchin said, quote, "Historic England has accepted the listing was a mistake. It was made by a junior officer who agreed to listing without ever seeing the structure itself. The application that was made was inaccurate, incomplete, and misleading, and would have put the progress and jobs at risk."
Now, progress.
Historic England.
Progress. There's the word again. You can't have progress without dynamite, remember?
Well, I think there are people that would disagree with that. And certainly, in this case, and it has to be said, I think relatively unusually, Historic England has stood their ground. And I think here it's worth quoting what the actual listing said. Now, the listing was taken down from the Historic England website because obviously it no longer had any legal standing. But fortunately, it was kept in the web archive of what's often called the Wayback Machine. Mm-hmm. And so we can actually see what the grounds were for listing the Dolman Long Tower. And it's listed on the grounds of architectural interest as a, quote, "recognised example of early brutalist architecture, a fine example of austere design, mm-hmm. A deliberately monumental architectural statement of confidence by the then newly denationalised Dolman Long Company in the mid-1950s, and a rare, quote, considered to be nationally unique surviving structure from the 20th century coal, iron and steel industry. Mm. A design which is above the purely function is also cleverly combines control room storage and firefighting functions to form a state-of-the-art coking plant. Nationally unique." Mm. You don't use those words in a heritage context unless you've considered them. And then it also talks about the historic interest as part of the heavy engineering and steel industry on Teesside, which was the principal industry for most of the 20th century. Giving the the listing references Mayor Hootchin's example of the Sydney Harbour Bridge being a monument to the skills and ability of the steel workers in the Northeast.
Yeah.
So that is what Mayor Hootchin is saying is a mistake. Mm. And Historic England have stood by their listing and basically said, no, it wasn't a mistake. We knew exactly what we were doing.
Yeah.
And that's where we stand at the moment. Both sides are disagreeing with each other. Mm. I think what the thing to watch is what comes out about the way this decision was made, the contacts between that may have taken place between Mayor Hootchin, the culture secretaries, first of all, Oliver Dowd, and then Nadine Dorries, and Historic England. Mm. Because it's clear Historic England, Historic England wouldn't have taken the stance they had if they didn't feel somewhat hard done by in this.
True, but also as well, arguably, they wouldn't have demolished the tower at 2 a.m. on Sunday the September of 19th in circumstances that were entirely... that they were entirely confident in and with. You know, normally these are daytime events. Normally people gather around and view these sort of collapses, and they aren't just sort of kind of rushed through like this. Now I suppose you could argue that the prep was ready, they were good to go, and they had to do it now. But it feels as if it was rushed through, an awful lot of commentary around it was essentially saying that this was rushing to finalise a decision, as it were. I won't use language along the lines of hiding a crime. I don't think that that's not entirely appropriate. Other people have been using that language, but it's more a case of it was trying to put a full stop on something rather than having a drawn out conversation.
Okay, I think people need to understand how these things work legally. The only lever that campaigners have in this kind of situation is something called judicial review.
Yeah.
And if there, it is possible to argue that what Mayor Hootchin was doing by rushing, what appears to be rushing through the demolition, was to create a full stop, as you've described it, before anybody on the conservation side could get together a judicial review, which is expensive and it is difficult and takes a little bit of organising, unless you've got a very clear, for example, an organisation which has a very clear purpose and money. So you can argue, as I say, that Hootchin was trying to prevent another intervention by creating a new reality. For example, a judicial review would be refused potentially on the grounds that actually whatever a judge decided, there was no public interest because the event had already happened.
Yes. Yeah.
There was no going back. Having said that, recently there was a precedent in North London that a developer who demolished a Grade 2 listed pub,
yes,
without planning permission, had to go back unlawfully. Had to go back and reconstruct it exactly. Mm. Now, here, planning permission was in place. The permission to demolish was in place. The listing overrode that. The listing was cancelled. Mm. So, if you went to JR, you'd have to prove another element of unlawfulness within the process. What has happened here is that whatever research might be going on into the process and the documents and the FOIs and things like that, in a sense, it now is only of historic interest because the courts will almost certainly not intervene because of the...
Because there's nothing to save.
Because of what's happened, there's nothing to save anymore. Exactly. No.
Yeah. I think it's probably worthwhile saying then that this does, as we draw this to a close, I suppose, this I think, sets a tone. I suppose first and foremost, as I always feel compelled to say in these cases, archaeologists are not anti-development. They aren't anti-progress. They don't just want to preserve things in aspic for the sake of preserving things in aspic. And in this instance, as I said at the beginning, I'm not convinced that the tower necessarily had to be kept. But it had to be probably better understood. The argument could have been more clearly made. The conversation, for example, surrounding the preservation of elements of the tower, such as the lettering on the side, could have been done with more care and due process for the sake of community and for the sake of that pride that the mayor apparently takes so much pride in. But regardless of that, regardless of the fact that you know, I keep on having to repeat this, the archaeologists aren't against progress. This is it sets a tone for the person in the new culture secretary, Nadine Dorris, that now archaeologists and other campaigners are having to deal with when it comes to the status of archaeology, heritage and other culture in this country, in terms of its funding, its value, its moral and ethical status, and so on and so forth. We are living in times when some of our national leaders don't want us to use the word crisis, but it does certainly, for people who are losing their jobs, feel like a time of crisis when university departments are being shut down, people are having their jobs put under review. We've lost in recent years the archaeology GCSE, the archaeology A level. Those are two high school qualifications for people who may not know. And conversations like this effortlessly. I'm quoting myself now, a tweet that I put out a few days ago, but they effortlessly hijack the national conversation. They effortlessly actually do what months of campaigning from well-meaning archaeologists and others have been trying to do, and that is complete an element of a conversation or a paragraph in a conversation on the national stage as to what we think of our physical heritage and how we deal with our physical heritage and actually what qualifies as heritage. some people were trying to make the case that this represented, you know, true working class heritage, and it's truly, you know, northern monumental stuff in its purest form. That may or may not be the case. I'd be interested to know if this was an Elizabethan watchtower or something like that, would it have stood more of a chance of staying stood up? It's hard to know in to a certain extent, but the fact that we have a Secretary of State who can come out with a simple pronouncement or just confirming her predecessor's point of view by making a statement like, oh, it's just essentially a functional building, doesn't speak to granular detail, doesn't speak to an interest in the stuff of culture, of heritage, of what makes a place actually interesting. And if nothing else, the information that can be taken from these places and these monuments and held within the community in other forms, it simply speaks of, well, I'm not interested, therefore it can go. And it sets an unfortunate tone. I can't help but wonder what this means for this ongoing conversation that we're having at the moment in this country, in the context of, as we've been covering recently on Watching Brief, you know, interviews with members of staff at Worcester, for example, at Sheffield and other places. Chester have just come out of a review process. Hull hasn't escaped unscathed. And there are others. But what do you think? Do you think that this was a, as I've seen described, this was a bit of a swift sort of slap on the wrist, if not a slight punishment beating, in fact, essentially saying, no, we're in charge, shut up, kind of thing?
Okay. Bit of historical perspective. I mean, first of all, yes, it is absolutely an argument, as we said earlier in this conversation. It's an argument about what is heritage, whose heritage, and who makes the decisions about heritage. Mm. You can argue, and some people have argued, that, for example, the Dorman Long Tower was a memorial, effectively, to generations of Teesside steelworkers, mm-hmm. Northeast steelworkers. Mm-hmm.
And incidentally, sorry, I don't mean to interrupt your train of thought there, but incidentally, just across the river in South Shields, there's the F Pit Museum. That's a pit head that's been saved as a local museum. Further north in Northumberland, yeah, there is the it's a museum and county, if not regional, archive that is also a pit head. They've kept the machine houses and other buildings.
And there's the Beamish Living History Centre.
Beamish Living History Centre, where they actually move these buildings to and reconstruct them.
Yeah.
Woodhorn, that's it, the Woodhorn Museum up in Northumberland. These buildings can have lives after their industrial selves, and they can be relevant structures, but... Sorry, I don't mean to break your train of thought. Continue.
No, you're quite right to raise those examples. You know, you can create a scenario whereby, in spite of, to be fair to Mayor Hootchin and the people who follow his side of the argument, a report by the consultants Atkins has been released, which suggested there were structural issues with the building, mm-hmm. and applying various costs to conserving it. Mm. Now, what that doesn't go into, of course, is the fact that, and as people have pointed out, there are things like the Heritage Lottery Fund, which exist to fund projects to turn buildings like that into buildings with a sustainable future that maybe contribute to the local economy as tourist attractions, for example. Mm. You know, and you can build a scenario whereby that could have been a viewpoint looking out over the coast, but also this wonderful new wind farm. Factory production facility that is going to be built on the site.
Yeah, it could have been the icon of the factory in that sense. Yeah,
absolutely. It could have been an iconic marker for past and present and future, with a bit of imagination.
Another example here on Tynemouth, there's the Low Lights Museum. That was a structure that was originally used as one or two structures to line up boats as they come into the river, so they know they're not going to beach themselves. But that building is no longer really in use for that purpose, but it was repurposed. And it's just up the coast from, not quite a stone's throw, but within some sort of mechanized launch, like a tennis ball maybe gun of a medieval monastery structure. So these things can, again, they can live in harmony with an ongoing community. But
But at the same time, there's an argument ongoing, I think, about the transporter bridge over the Tyne, which has broken down. And the question is it feasible to fix it at a reasonable cost?
Yeah. Well, that should also be said. So I don't know if we're getting off topic here, but I think it just, again, for people outside the region, it should also be said that people in the Northeast, and I was saying this to you yesterday, have always had a very pragmatic relationship with their physical heritage. So in Newcastle, for example, the dockside, the River Tyne quayside, has been constantly changing over the past, especially the past 200 years. It's unrecognisable from what it was 50 years ago, and in turn 50 years before that, and so on and so forth. If a structure exists that is, for example, Elizabethan, and there are a couple that have survived, they are prized because they somehow did survive, because people had a sense of the need for progress, the need for industry. Bottle making, for example, was happening on the south bank of the Tyne. Coal and other materials were coming to the Tyne through the town on the north side of the Tyne, and that's Tyne side as opposed to Tees Valley. But it's a very similar attitude. So. And it should be said one more thing, just another case for the another bit of evidence for the mayor's side of this case. It should be said that some people as well see these structures as monuments to almost economic exploitation. Actually, there are people who and I'm thinking now of the Welsh perspective, Welsh coal mining, where you hear stories of people who don't like pit heads because pit heads remind them of their family members who died of horrible lung complications, you know, coal dust, etc., getting into the body. So
I mean, similar thing. I've heard. I was involved in a planning issue where a local councillor opposed the retention of a possibly unique World War II air raid shelter within the development site, because, as he said, my mum hated them and was pleased to, you know, almost applauded when she saw them being torn down at the end of the war.
But isn't that the point? You see, what we've just both pointed to touch that there, and this is exactly my point about Nadine Dorris, that is a personal anecdote. That's a personal perspective, a personal valuation of something, as opposed to actually what does it mean objectively for a community.
Okay, let me finish with a bit of perspective here, because we're historians, we're archaeologists, we go with data and we go with perspective and we look at historical perspectives. We've been here before. In the early years of the Cameron Coalition in 2010, 2011, 2012, there was a proposed development called Broadgate next to Liverpool Street Station in the City of London. The 1980s Broadgate development was by a internationally famous British architect called Peter Foggo, the late Peter Foggo, working for, a world-famous international consultancy called OVARUP. It won awards. It was seen as state-of-the-art for its period, which is the mid-80s. In 2010, a company called British Land proposed redeveloping the site for, I think it was Swiss Re was the company they were working for, and had as a client, and that involved removing parts of the Foggo design. Historic England recommended it be listed Grade 2 star, I think, if I remember correctly, because of its association with Peter Foggo, and because it was, although it was a relatively recent building, it was seen as absolutely emblematic of the best of architecture of that period. The then Secretary of State, Jeremy Hunt, very deliberately and publicly refused the listing. That was before the listing was granted. Now, the other piece of information that is important to this is that British Land, which is the company that was involved in developing the site, and in fact has developed the site, was closely associated with the then Chancellor of the Exchequer, George Osborne. He in fact appeared at the breaking ground ceremony in full hy-vee on the Broadgate site. And in fact, one of the senior officers of British Land was appointed by the then government, the Cameron government, to look at ways of liberalising planning laws, and particularly regarding heritage laws. So there is a, and given the current government's rhetoric about build back better and leveling up and so on and build, the there is an argument that, yes, what we have seen here, the timing is accidental. The timing between, you know, the fact that it happened, it was the first thing that Nadine Dorries did, is accidental. I suspect Oliver Dowden would have done exactly the same thing had he remained in post. Mm-hmm. And what this is at least in part, if not a punishing beating, a reminder to historic England that we know where your office is and you know, by the way, who provides you with your budget, don't you?
Yeah. Mm. 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 And the question is, where do we go from there? How do we deal with those people? But I don't suppose that's something that you and I can answer in the next 30 seconds or so.
No. All I would say is that the push to preserve the Dorman Long Tower came from civil society. Mm. And some politicians went along with it at least for a while.
And then they became activists.
The language, that kind of language is deliberately provocative. It's designed to create a deliberate image of, you know, it's one step from wanting to preserve a Dorman Long Tower to sitting on the M25 stopping the traffic.
Yes.
That's, you know, that's the kind of image that they're trying to build in PR terms. But I think what that shows is that one of the enemies of this kind of development at all costs and the past gets in the way is civil society. Mm. And if civil society objects, it can be very powerful and can chuck a very large spanner in the works if it knows how the works work. And that means particularly, you know, it's why the current government is trying to, quote, reform judicial review to make it more difficult. They know it's one of the few levers that's left that civil society has that can bring government, local government, government entities to account.
Yeah.
And that's what's going on here, I think.
Mm. Okay.
That's what they're afraid of.
Okay, well, it's been an interesting week. I'm sure this story isn't fully finished. We're likely to see more come
far from it.
But hopefully this sort of bumper episode has covered what happened and some of the issues surrounding it for you. So please do feel free to comment below if you want to add to this conversation. And also, actually, if you're from Redcar, from the area, feel free to comment on what you think of the tower falling down. In that sense, falling down, being brought down, rather. It wasn't a passive accident. There is undoubtedly a spectrum of responses to this happening in the way that it happened. So feel free to comment below. Thank you guys for watching. Thank you for your time, Andy, this week. And if you like what we do here in The Watching Brief, please do consider supporting us on Patreon. You can support us for as little as £1 per month or $1 per month on the Patreon website, link below. Your support is very welcome, and it allows us to at least, you know, to have the old penny sweet while we're putting our agenda together. We can, you know, have some chewing gum or a nice cough cop. What's your favourite sweet, Andy, actually?
I'm not a sweets person. I do have a real soft spot for donuts.
Oh, donuts. Okay. Interesting. Well, Mrs. Soup is a big fan of Clove Rock. Have you ever had Clove Rock before?
No. Is that some kind of northeastern delicacy?
Well, actually, no. I don't know. I don't know if it is northeastern. It was in York when I lived there. But in particular, she obviously grew up in Northern Ireland, so it was there. And it tastes kind of, she describes it as tasting like dental mouthwash.
Oh my goodness.
But it's actually quite pleasant, so I'll leave you with that image anyway. Clove Rock, try it out if you can. Thank you guys for watching. Until next time, do take care. Bye-bye.
This podcast episode has been produced by the Archaeology Podcast Network in collaboration with ArchaeoSoup Productions. Find out more podcasts at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.